Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say you, Richard Pellett Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them, okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
Welcome to Unsolved, South Carolina, the Murdoch Murders, Money and Mystery. I'm Ann Emerson. I'm joined today with our exclusive legal analyst, the former South Carolina Attorney General, Charlie Condon. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Our executive producer, Drew Tripp. We've got Tara Jabor, reporter extraordinaire at WCIV, and has been covering this Murdoch case since the very beginning. And we have Max Harrison, of course. He's running the boards, and he's keeping track of our clips that we're going to be sharing with you today. We had an extraordinary experience. We had the opportunity as a team to go up to Columbia and meet with the Attorney General's office, the five members of the prosecution team on the double murder trial of Alec Murdoch. They were candid. They were authentic. Mm-hmm. I thought they gave us an incredible amount of information. The interview alone with this five-member panel went on for almost 2 hours. And their voices that you're going to hear, and hopefully you'll be able to, if you're listening to this as opposed to watching it, you'll be able to differentiate these voices. But we'll try and help you out as we go along. But we had the Attorney General, Alan Wilson. He was there. And of course, if you were watching the trial, you'd remember that he was sitting there, right there in that front line with the prosecutors throughout this case. We had Savannah Gowd. Savannah was one of the prosecutors as well. We had John Metters with us, joined us for the interview. We had David Fernandez, and of course, the lead prosecutor for the state, Creighton Waters, was there. Extraordinary opportunity, I thought, to let them speak amongst themselves. It was sort of, you know, it was the five, the how many of us are there? Yes, there was five of us, and there were five of them. And, you know, it felt more like a conversation than an interview. We gave each one of them a moment to take the floor and tell us a little bit about their experience. But what was really nice about this experience for me personally was to see them interacting with each other. And when you've been embedded in something like this, and this is sort of our team that was there, as well as Sam Griswold, another one of our photogs, we know what it feels like. And they had their own kind of way of speaking, all of their inside jokes. And it was nice to be able to hear how they communicated with each other. What did you think, Charlie?
No, I agree. It was a remarkable event, and it was a privilege for me to be there in the setting. If I can talk about that a little bit. Because we were actually in the state grand jury room. And a little background on that, and it's called the Travis Medlock Room. It's dedicated to the former Attorney General of South Carolina who started the state grand jury. And in the actual room where all the financial crimes would have been presented to jurors and indictments forthcoming, the murder case, that would have been through the Collin County grand jury, the local grand jury. But still, we had the setting where we were talking to these individuals where all these financial crimes. And you had the heart credit, again, to setting up this interview, because we had the very hard news that came out of the interview that the Attorney General was going to prosecute all 99 financial crimes and seek another life without parole sentence for Alec Murdoch. And we'll talk about that a bit, I'm sure, as sort of an insurance policy against the murder conviction. So it was just a privilege for me to be there.
I could tell it was a privilege for you to be there. The word I would use for you, Charlie, was eager. Charlie was asking all just bam, 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 question after question. And he was thinking ahead, and he was bouncing off of them and coming up with just, and he helped us get, he thought of stuff that we did not think of, which is exactly why we were so adamant to have him involved in everything that we've done covering this trial, and so thankful to have him along, because it was really helpful.
Oh, thank you.
And it was also kind of fun to just sit there and see you just kind of, like I said, eager a little bit. You were clearly enjoying yourself.
Kid in the candy store, wasn't it?
Yeah, and also, getting to question them, be a reporter.
Yeah, yeah, and also if you think about the setting there, you had the top law enforcement officer in South Carolina, the Attorney General, with his team there. And it was just an opportunity that I don't think I'll ever have again in my life to question somebody in a major trial as to how they made certain decisions, where, when, and how. And it was no holds barred. Nothing was off limits. So I was very, very impressed with their attitude and the willingness to answer any and all questions.
Yeah. Yeah, one thing I thought that was kind of funny during that was at first we thought the Attorney General would only be there for, you know, maybe 20 minutes or so. And Charlie, you and him both got the opportunity to go back and forth. I thought that was just so special because you guys have a relationship. Obviously, you hired Creighton Waters. So it was funny because Attorney General Alan Wilson ended up staying a lot longer than we thought he would.
Yeah, it was great to have him there.
It was. It was really great. And one of the questions right off the bat, one of the questions that we asked was at what point, what was that turning point for the AG's office to move forward with the indictments?
Mm-hmm.
And when were they ready to really make that decision? And we've got a clip right here explaining some of it, and we can certainly help explain more. And we'll try and help you differentiate the voices as well as we listen to this clip with you.
Well, it was actually in this room. SLED, obviously, I think the kennel video was found in April, like 2 months earlier, and I was aware of it, but I don't think I saw it until early July of last year. And it was a couple of us, you were there, SLED came over, Chief Keel was here, and they basically did a presentation up into the critical decision point to say, okay, this is what we think we have, and this is our theory of the case at this time.
I actually did a 40-slide PowerPoint in this room as we made that final decision.
That's right.
Which I actually sanitized a good bit, which was one of the PowerPoints during the closing argument. But it was right up there on that screen as we kind of went through all of that and presented it to the command staff and the command staff for SLED. And at that point, the David Owen, the case agent, and the other agents involved, and we were like, hey, bosses, we think it's time to go.
You made the decision, General, on that day.
I did. I made that decision.
Okay, so that was a great example of how they were all sitting together. They're all kind of weighing in on what's going on. You heard a lot of A.G. Wilson at the top, and Creighton Waters sort of pipes in to say that he had done this 40-slide PowerPoint presentation about how they were going to move forward with this extremely serious double murder charge that they were charging another lawyer from a prominent family of solicitors. Charlie, what would it have been like in that room? Were you kind of living that experience with them as they were talking about this?
I can remember the day when I heard about these indictments and I thought to myself, I'm assuming they've got a really good case, because if they don't, and again, you don't want to have politics enter into a decision to prosecute or not prosecute, but stepping back from this, it wasn't as if your typical criminal case in South Carolina begins with an arrest warrant getting into the system, and then you decide whether or not to prosecute or not to prosecute. This was not that case at all. This was a case in which the Attorney General generated the information and the evidence, and the Attorney General was going to decide whether or not to go forward with an indictment. So there was, and it took so long. What was it, like a year and a half or so after the murder?
It was. Mm-hmm.
And so there was really no...
It was 13 months.
13 months.
Yeah, there was really no, and of course you kept hearing from the defense, in effect, that that he was innocent, or information to that effect that seemed to be leaking throughout the press. And so from my perspective, I was thinking that the fact that there was the trigger was pulled, that I thought at the time, I'm assuming, just knowing the good common sense that General Wilson has, that it was a good solid case that they had. Otherwise, why would you put yourself in the middle of such a, really, the potentiality for this to be a disastrous prosecution? Could have been there if the evidence wasn't there. Because if you crank something up like this and indict somebody of his stature for murder and you don't get a successful prosecution going, it may not look good for you long term, to say the least.
Well, and you're talking, I mean, because obviously, you know, in the state of South Carolina, you're going to have to elect that AG position. You were, you know, mm-hmm. you went through the process.
Yeah.
And those questions would come up, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and, you know, not to put too much into this, but, I mean, you had Dick, and Dick and I are now friends, but Dick, former chairman of the State Democratic Party, Alan Wilson, Republican, he's representing Alec Murdoch. If you could, I can only imagine the sound bites going forward if there was a not guilty verdict. And in fact, there were some, I can remember one press conference explicitly where I think Dick was in front of his office saying that it was a political prosecution. And so the risk reward out there, I thought, was high. And again, I'm sure he had nothing, didn't think the least bit about politics. But when he made that decision to go forward after so many months after the murders, it just occurred to me that, wow, I'm just assuming they've got some good, and, you know, at the end of the day, it's still a circumstantial evidence case. But I do think the circumstances were such that it ended up being a strong case.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, what did you guys feel like when I was in the room? You know, we're sitting in the state mm-hmm. grand jury room, as you said, and just after what we've witnessed with Creighton Waters, we've watched him do these presentations. When these guys had and gals with Savannah there, you know, had to hear what was about to go down, and that Kennel video surfaces, sounds like that was probably a very important part of this presentation. Yeah.
I think I remember a line from our interview that John Metter said. He said, you know, he went home one night and he was telling his wife about the Kennel video, and she told him, "You have it right there. You have this case right there with that video." And you could tell that video was extremely important to them. You know, we had heard about maybe some videos. What are these videos? And you know, when there was that day in court and they put that video up and they kept that theme, all those people identifying Alec Murdoch, Alec Murdoch, Alec Murdoch. And then he gets on the stand and for the first time ever he says, "Yes, I was there. I was at the kennels."
I know. But to get to that point, I do think that the state did a really good job of, because he had an alibi of sorts, isn't he? He put a notice of alibi in. And for the state to get to the point where he was forced to do that, I do think, again, the fact that they, in effect, pulled the trigger in that very room at that moment in time, I thought it was just a great opportunity for us. And again, I may be injecting too much in the way of the politics of this, but I do think that had to be some of the backdrop to all this, particularly with state law enforcement division being involved, the Attorney General's office being involved, the players on the defense side. And again, I have a lot of respect for Dick and for Jim, but I do have to think that at some point in time, if the case went south, and y'all have covered moments where it did seem to be going south, particularly with the blood spatter evidence that went south, I do think that the risk that was being taken relative to the state, I thought that it was a really good moment for them, that they looked at the evidence. Everyone in the room looked at it. We're in that very room where it was shown, and they made the decision in hindsight, which is a perfectly proper, laudable decision. But it took some courage, I believe, to do that, and I commend them for it.
So tell me, just technically, I was kind of curious about this. What happens once that, you know, that trigger is pulled by the AG? What happens?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward, really. You type up indictments and schedule something with the Colleton County Grand Jury, and you have David Owens go in there, and present it, and you get true bills. I think that was the procedure they used. They could have gone to a magistrate and issued arrest warrants and had him arrested that way, but as I recall, they did it that way, didn't they? Indictments from the grand jury, then had him booked in on the indictment. So the two different ways they could have gone forward, but I believe they just chose the more straightforward approach, going directly to the grand jury and getting murder indictments, as I recall.
He was already in jail anyway at that point. So.
Oh, that's true. I do remember there being some questions about why it didn't go to the state grand jury versus the Colorado
jurisdiction. That's such a great question, because let me give you some backdrop on this. So the statewide grand jury has jurisdiction over computer crimes, and of course now everything can be computers, and so that's how they got jurisdiction over Alec Murdoch for the financials, but they didn't have jurisdiction for murder. So that's why they had to go county.
Hi, everyone. This is Drew. Just want to let you know, for the next several seconds of the podcast, you're going to hear a lot of background noise. Unfortunately, while we were recording, there was some activity going on in the garage area of our news station, and the room where we were recording was right next to that. So for the next few seconds, you're going to hear a lot of background noise. You may have to lower or raise your volume a little bit to understand what we're saying. We do apologize for this. It wasn't really in our control, but we just wanted to give you a little heads up about what's going on with this. It's over in about 20, 30 seconds. Thanks.
That's so interesting. Now, another pivotal moment for me, when we were in the arraignment of Alec Murdoch, I remember I was texting with Charlie right afterwards, I think it was right afterwards, once he got indicted for the double murders, and Don Zelenka was in the room. And you texted me and said, Don Zelenka is, amongst other things, just being a brilliant lawyer that he is, he's also one of the death penalty sort of experts for the state of South Carolina. So that immediately, you know, alarm bells start going off. Are they going to be looking at the death penalty? So obviously that isn't the decision they made, but we wanted to understand why it wasn't the decision they made to go for the death penalty.
I'm a supporter of the death penalty, but you also have to look at the individual, and sometimes life without parole is a worse crime, or worse punishment, rather, for an individual than the death penalty would be. This is a family that is both the victim of this horrible, horrific double murder and all that Alec Murdoch did in the years leading up. They were left in the wake as well, but also they were sitting behind Alec, and a number of them were very supportive. And again, when you're considering the death penalty, asking for the state to take someone's life, you have to factor in victim impact.
You're talking about a 6-week trial. It's already an extremely complex trial. You add the death penalty to it, and we're talking about maybe a 12-week trial. We wanted to try this case in Colleton County. I'm a firm believer that, you know, a lot of people ask, why didn't you try to change venue? I'm a firm believer in it, you know, let the community where this happened have their voice on it.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And this is just a little bit of the conversation that was going on, but they actually kind of gave us some really good reasons, didn't they, of why death penalty just didn't suit this case.
Yeah, Charlie, so, you know, we heard Creighton Waters say that it would have been a 12-week trial. I'm not from South Carolina. Why would have it almost doubled the length of the trial?
The main reason it would lengthen the trial is in death penalty cases, you have individual voir dire of the jurors to see if they're death qualified. And what that means is if you say that you're always for the death penalty in every murder case, you're disqualified. And if you say that you're never for the death penalty case, regardless of the facts, you're not qualified. So you bring your jurors up, you go back and forth on that issue. And that can be a fact, if you ever get a chance to watch that, because jurors are confused because the roles are reversed in that back and forth, because the state often is, somebody gets up there as law and order type, nope, eye for an eye for a tooth, tooth for a tooth. And so if someone commits murder, they need to put to death. Well, you, as the prosecutor, you want them on the jury. So you then start saying, well, wait a minute, can't there be extenuating circumstances? What if he had a... And so the juror's like confused because he's thinking the prosecutor's like, well, why are you challenging my belief? I should be a good person. So you're trying to get him to say, oh, I could consider a life sentence maybe if there's some extenuating circumstance. So he gets qualified. The flip of that is, on the defense side, if somebody gets up there, no, I can never put somebody in an electric chair. I'm sorry, I can never do that. So the defense lawyer then starts saying, wait a minute, now what if you had Satan himself? Couldn't you put Satan to death? And the juror gets confused because it looks like the defense lawyer is trying to talk him into capital punishment, but he's trying to get him qualified. So you get 10 strikes for the defense and 5 for the state, and so you want to get a big pool of jurors that are sympathetic to your cause. And that back and forth typically, in my experience, on each juror is like half an hour to an hour back and forth, times how many jurors we had. It probably would have added maybe 2 or 3 days. And then the other lengthening of the trial is after the guilt verdict on murder, if you get that, you have to wait for a day until the penalty phase starts. And you go back and forth on what's called mitigating circumstances and aggravating circumstances. I'm not so sure it would add that much length to the trial as Creighton suggested, but it certainly would have added weeks. So.
Wow. Well, and the other point that they made, which was not lost on anyone that sat in that courtroom or even a lot of the time mm-hmm. that they were watching that courtroom, there were so many members of the Murdoch family there, and it was, as you've spoken before about, it's super confusing, but just very hard to see how they are not only trying to support Alec Murdoch as the defendant, they're also the victims of this heinous crime.
Yeah, I thought a fascinating point that General Wilson made, and I didn't really think about it, in that you would not have had people supporting Alex being put to death sitting in there, because Maggie's family really didn't show except for that one day when they were subpoenaed. So in your typical death penalty case, you do have a row or two of folks that are looking for justice. And it does, we were all there. It creates a different atmosphere when you have people sitting there each and every day wanting a certain result. And so it's true. During that trial, the people that you had sitting there each and every day were simply the defendant's family wanting him to be acquitted, is my view.
Well, and then Waters' point, too, I guess this is off a little bit, but he said he really wanted to try this case in Colton County. He's a firm believer that a lot of people ask, why didn't you change the venue? He said, I'm a firm believer in letting the community where this crime happened have a voice on it. And, Drew, coming from Colton County area, that we talked about this so much before the trial about how in the world they were going to be able to find a group of people that weren't intimidated or had some connection to the Murdochs. But it wasn't really, as far as the connection part, that didn't really play into it. They had to just be, they probably did know the Murdochs, right?
Yeah, or know of them. Or the way I would phrase it in my experience growing up there, certainly you knew of the Murdochs, the solicitors. I've explained it this way to people before. The idea that the Murdoch family was some sort of, I don't know, this looming presence of any sort over the community, that might have been true in the 70s and 80s, and 60s, 70s, 80s, maybe a little bit up into the 90s as well. I think if you're really digging into that family's background, the Alex grandfather, Buster Murdoch, Randolph Murdoch Jr., who was solicitor from the 1940 to 1986, chewed tobacco in the courtroom. He was involved in all sorts of scandals. He was kind of the larger than life figure in that family, and was tied to scandals and things like that. I think there may be, for some people, I don't think that there's this widespread like registry of those are the Murdochs. You got to watch out for them. They'll get you. I don't feel like it's that, but I feel like more so the reputation belongs to the law firm the PMPED law firm, the former PMPED. I would say in that community, the names Johnny Parker, Ronnie Crosby, Mark Ball, they carried every bit as much clout for the reasons of the law firm carries clout as the name, the Murdoch name in particular does. That's just my assessment. I may be wrong. It could be generational. I'm in my mid-30s. I would maybe my parents' generation, people in their 50s and 60s, would say differently. But that's just my assessment on it. But I did think it was interesting. Again, we asked them about this, that both Creighton and John Metters mentioned again the fact that they had worked with the Murdochs, Randolph Murdoch III, handsome as they called him. They'd worked with him at points in their careers and knew him and respected him. And, you know, just, but again, just from my perspective, it was.
Did it make much of a difference it being Colleton County versus Hampton County?
It may have. I just think that the process is such that you, unless you have some real shenanigans going on or you have some real dishonest people, the process of is such that you're going to get the best possible people that you can in any community. And I you know, I don't know all those jurors. I was actually a bit surprised by the fact that I did not know more of the jurors. And I certainly saw familiar faces coming in and out. For jury qualification, the first couple of days, I saw faces that I knew. I just found out over the weekend that someone I went to high school with was on the grand jury that indicted him. I didn't even realize that at the time, and I had even seen them at the courthouse the day of the grand jury indictments, and it didn't put two and two together because it was later after the fact that it had, that I saw them. And anyway, but there's one person who I do know was on the jury, and someone I've known a long time, and someone who I have a ton of respect for, and know that they are a very fair-minded and very the type of person you would want to have your fate in their hands, because you know that they're going to give you their best, and they're going to represent the community well, but they're also going to represent your interests well as a defendant up there. And that's what I'll say for that person. They don't want to be identified publicly. They've declined at this time to do any interviews, but I think the process works, and Colleton County was well represented and they were well equipped to handle it.
Well, so there was another very interesting opportunity that we had while we were meeting with this group, and that was to find out why, because we had, one of the reasons that we asked this question is we had not seen the Attorney General himself at the motion hearings. He had not taken part in the arraignment of Alec Murdoch. He was kind of working behind the scenes, but we were not privy to what that actually meant. So when he showed up sort of the first week of the trial, I think it was within the first couple of days of the trial, that Wilson sort of took his seat along with the other prosecutors was fascinating. So we wanted to find out, why did AG decide to take part in this trial?
I will say this. I made for great theater that the last case or the last witness in the state's rebuttal case was done by me. That wasn't planned that way. You know, I had been there. First off, I want to go back and say why I was there to begin with. I came down, I think I got there, I had conflicts the first week. I couldn't be there for the jury voir dire and all of that and the openings, but I was there for the last 5 weeks. And the reason I chose to be there is a couple of reasons. This is a high-stakes game here. This is a high-stakes trial. The eyes of the world were watching. The office was under a microscope. I have 1,000% faith in the team going down there, but I knew that if things didn't go well, they were putting their necks out on the line. You know, and I said, they need to see me putting my neck out on the line with them. So I was going to put myself there, and I was going down to not be the attorney general, to be another staff attorney, and to be a support attorney to help the team out. And also to say, hey, I'm going to put myself out there with you. These folks are staying away from their families for 6 weeks. Real life is happening back home. Kids are getting sick. You know, loved ones are getting injured. You know, my wife was going through an ordeal at the time. They're going to be away from their families. I'm going to be away from my family. They're going to live in a hotel dorm room lifestyle for, you know, we didn't know it would be 6 weeks, but they're going to be there for a month plus. Right. I'm going to be there with them. As the case started to unpack itself, I went to Creighton because I knew Creighton was really pulling, his bandwidth is at his ends. And I went to him and I said, hey, listen, I'm happy to continue being a support staff. I'm happy to continue sitting there and passing notes and doing research and giving ideas out. But if you want me to take a witness, if you want me to help out, I used to be a prosecutor. You know, I used to do this and I enjoyed it. And so he said, well, the opportunity presents itself, you will. And then I think the weekend before, we didn't even plan it to be the last witness. I went to him and I said, listen, and I want to give credit to David Fernandez and Creighton Waters. Creighton took Kenny Kinsey in the state's chief case. Mm-hmm. And David is the one that did the cross on the defense expert that came up with those preposterous and ridiculous theories that the bandits were 5'2 to 5'4 and that there were two of them. And so what I did is I was obviously there. I took copious notes for both his direct of Kenny and his cross of the defense's expert and took very detailed notes and went back and rewatched their examinations and sat down with Kenny Kinsey and was able to come up with the idea of how we would tear apart the defense's theory and do that, you know, do the gun in the doorway. And so it was just building blocks that they laid down for me. And again, it wasn't, my daughter was in the audience, but I didn't know that she was going to be there the day that I was going to take the witness. So it made good theater, but it wasn't planned that way.
I wrote a little sticky to him when he got through and I said, you go, AG.
John Meadors. That was John Meadors closing it out. He's a special guy.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about him in more in just a minute because there's some really fascinating observations that I think we all made about watching John Meadors in there. But and what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, you know, back to you, Charlie. You know, as far as you were talking about sort of the risk versus reward, you know, all of that. I think when we saw the AG get up, of course, he's an incredibly accomplished attorney in his own right, and he was. He looked like he was part of the team, but that's a big deal to get up there and sort of pull off
at that moment. Remember the moment too. Yeah. It was a key witness in the state's rebuttal and the last one, right? It was the last one. And if that didn't go well, that would have stuck in everyone's craw. Dr. Kinsey, of course, is a terrific witness, but still, I thought the examination was crisp. The visuals that he used, which, by the way, the defense let them use their Doug Brown, I think is his name, who people knew as Elmo. He put the visuals up, and it was just a really, really crisp direct examination with a nice visual. Remember the gun he used pointing there in the doorway of near the jury box with Dr. Kinsey? What a great moment for General Wilson. And oh, by the way, I see where the defense, not the defense, but the folks investigating the Stephen Smith case have now hired Dr. Kinsey to be the lead investigator. So that's a development there, isn't it?
Very interesting, yes. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of faith in Dr. Kinsey, especially after he was able to just unravel so much of what was going on at that crime scene. It was fascinating. And, yeah, it made great theater. He's right. I mean, you didn't forget that. You know, we work in television, so we get it. You know, you got to show people what you're talking about for them to understand. So I thought that was really interesting, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, Tanner.
Oh, no, you go first.
Well, I was just going to add to Charlie's point. I thought Alan Wilson was very impressive in his element, and he's not trying cases all the time anymore, but you have to remember what his background is. He's an attorney. He's an attorney before he's an elected official, and that's how he rose through the ranks. And he did, you could very clearly tell he was in his comfort zone, and he had a command of the room that was effective, and he had a presence of mind about what to do, when to do it, and when not to do it. In a very simple gesture he did that I thought was very impressive and effective was he got to a point where it was time to reference the crime scene and autopsy photos, and he said, we're not going to show them. You've seen them enough. Mm. And then he just moved on to the next thing. And small gesture. But if you're a jury who has been subjected, and I can speak to that, and having heard some of them and spoken to one directly, life-changing is a way to describe what they saw and what they experienced. You're not the same after what they had to see. And Alan was cognizant of that and said, we're not going to look at that again. You've seen it enough. Just a small moment that really stood out to me, and that really sold just his command of the room while he was up there doing that.
Drew, I was literally going to say the same thing, which you stole my beat. But I thought, you know, when he spoke, everyone was listening. And they mentioned this in the interview, right? We've already been hearing these attorneys for 6 weeks. We're in the rebuttal and we hear a new voice, someone different, a different style. You know, we knew Creighton's style. We knew Savannah's style. We knew David's style in this trial, but Metters. We had not heard. We knew Metters. He was definitely, you know, he had great presence. But then the attorney general stood up and we heard this different style, and people wanted to pay attention because it was a different voice and it was someone new. And I remember at one point when he was questioning Dr. Kinsey, he recited, like, you said at hour 27 and, you know, yes, your testimony when you were on direct. And I was like, whoa, he knew the exact hour and minute that Kinsey said that when he was on direct. Just, you know, that quick, exact thing that I think anyone can respect, right?
Sure.
Yeah, I think that is right on. He did what he needed to do there, which was, number one, support his team and not leave them all out to dry, as he said. That takes true leadership. But also to be able to do that kind of cross, yeah, it was impressive. Now, the next thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was something that we've been touching on our stories as well, because we wanted to know what the prosecution thought was their most powerful witness. So here's a little bit of a taste of what that is. And before we play the clip, Max, I just want to let people know, if you're watching this on video, we have taken the liberty to shorten some of these clips a little bit, taking out a little bit of the extra fluff so that we get a tighter clip. So if you watch it, you'll see those transitions. So I just wanted you to know what that was.
Kenny Kinsey, probably. He was really, really clutch. I thought this was a different kind of case because of how complex it was with the family and the friends, many of whom had loved this man but had no idea who he was. And we had to handle that with a delicate nature. But I think that, you know, some of the times where you saw people describe Paul and Maggie and you got to see, you know, the human side of them, you know, that was important. Blanca was one witness that did that. Marion, you know, did that. Ronnie Crosby did that.
It's Alex.
I was going to say that.
Alex.
Yeah.
Powerful.
Against himself.
If our witness powerful, right, I would say Marion Proctor. I don't think she brought, as far as evidence, but she was a true victim, and they got, I think the juxtaposition between herself and Alex is that she genuinely was torn apart by what happened.
Yeah.
It was true emotions from her, and you couldn't, your heart broke. I was horribly upset hearing her testimony. It was very upsetting. Alex was, I think, phony. It didn't come through.
And Alex was the most powerful witness against Alex, but I think Shelley was powerful.
Shelley.
Just to be there and see her reacting to him wanting her, Alex wanting her to lie, I thought was it.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
And if you're not, if you're need some refresher on those voices. The last two you heard were John Metters, the more southern accent, the deeper voice, and the other was David Fernandez, who was with the Attorney General's office, who we heard described as Creighton Waters' right-hand man. He didn't have an outsized role in the overall prosecution in things like that, but he did have some key witnesses in there, and he was certainly involved just as everyone else was. We heard a lot more from David in this intimate setting and got a lot better sense of who he was and how he thinks and what he was, in how he was seeing the world through this trial in our five-on-five interview that we had with them there. Really, really insightful, sharp guy. And I thought it was, when we posed that question, who did you think the most, who did you think was the most powerful witness? I was halfway expecting someone to say Alec, and then there was John Metters and David Fernandez, like, right on top of each other, Alec, and that's true. I've used this analogy so many times, and you're going to roll your eyes here. If you've been listening to back issues of this podcast, if you've read my Twitter or anything like this, I cannot stress enough to you how, in going back to the federal trial for Russell Lafitte, the federal bank fraud trial, Russell Lafitte, Alec Murdoch's co-conspirator in many of the thefts and the frauds and the money laundering schemes that he's been implicated in. When Russell Lafitte got on the stand initially in his federal trial, a light switch flipped. He changed the momentum briefly, albeit briefly. He changed the momentum because he was believable and he seemed somewhat authentic. And he cracked open that door of reasonable doubt as we're getting here. Very quickly, the U.S. Attorney's Office came and kicked that door back in his face when just covered him up in evidence that he was full of it. But at least from the I guess you would call it, well, this no, I was going to say cult of personality, but that's not right. But the force of his personality and his presence up on the witness stand, he was able to redirect the momentum for a brief minute. I have told everyone who's asked, Alec didn't do that for a second. Alec Murdoch lost me within the moment he opened his mouth to say why he lied about being at the kennels. It was over for me. And it just went downhill and got worse and worse for Alec. And I think he was absolutely the most powerful witness and the most powerful witness against himself, as John Metters and David Fernandez said.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. And then let's take that straight to the cross on Alec. That was Creighton Waters had that opportunity to cross him after he initially had been, because obviously he was up there in his own defense. When they do the direct with him, he basically admits for the first time that he lied to everyone about being at the kennels on that kennel video.
Looking at this guy and what we knew about him, I thought that I wanted to get him talking. I wanted to let him answer those questions. I wanted the jury to see him perfect his lie and lie to them in real time. And I thought that, you know, there's a wonderful common sense, collective common sense with the jury system. And I just thought that they'd be able to see that. I mean, I had pauses for a reason, because he couldn't help himself. He would start talking again, and then I'd be like, okay, well, great, let's talk about that. Oh, that's a new one. All right, let's talk about that one. And so it was a different sort of thing. He's, you know, also a very, very smart individual. He's a trial lawyer, so that's a tough draw as a cross. There's a lot of body language that I think was very key with him. You know, one of the things that, you know, I think I mentioned to the jury that to me is very telling is that when he would answer, you know, ultimate questions with a lie, he would shake his head yes. And I saw that on the videotapes as well.
He had created this lie before he even knew Sled would be involved the minute Daniel Green arrived on scene.
Yeah.
And for Alex, it was crucial because he'd committed to this fabrication. We could prove it's just not true. He had, and he described himself, this web of lies, this that he woven.
the truth is easy to recite. The truth is easy to stick to, and the truth adds up when someone, you know, has to be questioned on the outer perimeters of it. Alex had created this web of lies, and his whole life was based on lies, and it was hard for him to keep up with it. And I think you saw that on the stand.
Don't lie.
Don't lie. I mean, boy, did we hear the word lie. I would love to go through all of the transcripts of these court transcripts and see how many times they actually had to use the word lie. I think in the story, to give you a preview of what I'm working on for tonight for the newscast, it was about how he was lying about lying. And now he's lying about lying to investigators. And it's just, you can't make this stuff up. Like, you're like, did you just lie about lying?
Oh, it's oh. And again, I'll circle back to the related issue of Russell Lafitte. In the meantime, if you remember during trial, Alec used his soapbox up there on the witness stand to say, oh, and by the way, Russell Lafitte never had anything to do with any of the crime. He didn't know he was doing anything wrong. I tricked him and I lied to him too. And, you know, he's innocent, which just ignores mountains of evidence to the contrary, as was proven in his federal trial. But since then, and this is developed in the last couple of weeks, since then Russell Lafitte's attorneys have filed a motion for a retrial in federal court with Judge Richard Gergel. Their first one got shot down. They filed a new one based on Alec's testimony for saying that that Russell didn't do anything. And you understand, defense attorneys have a job to do. Of course, they're looking for any opportunity they can to defend their client and get him out of the conviction he has and keep him out of prison. Still, it doesn't detract from the humor of the fact that Russell Lafitte is going off. Hey, listen, this guy, my buddy Alec, he said, he's telling you, I didn't have anything to do with this. You can listen to Alex, trust him. And the obvious rebuttal to that is he is a notorious liar at this point. And then last week we get the federal government's rebuttal to the response in opposition, as it's called, to Lafitte's lawyer's motion for retrial. And Katie Staunton, one of the prosecutors, she goes through and footnote lists 30 different times Alec Murdoch on the witness stand admitted to lying during the murder trial. And I just thought it was just one of the most beautiful and brutal at the same time, just like stiff arm rejections of, like, as she even said, I cannot think of a more unreliable witness for this defendant to be using. As a small tangent there, but I just thought that was, it's not funny, but just within the scope of itself, there's certainly an element of humor to this and how much Alec Murdoch lied. But transitioning back, Charlie, how fun was it sitting there? I can recall listening to you and us kind of bouncing off each other, sitting in that house in Waldorf the night after all this, and be like, did you notice how he was walking away from Alec and he was doing those pregnant pauses and Alec couldn't help himself but to fill in the silences? And we were wondering, was that part of his strategy all along, or did he do that? And we got the opportunity to ask Creighton Waters about that. And yeah, that was part of his strategy. Like, yes. And it wasn't just on the fly. That's one of the things I asked about. I was like, well, Creighton, day one versus day two was a little different from you. And Creighton was like, oh, I was just stalling on day one. Like, I knew I wasn't going to be able to finish that day, so I just was up there basically wasting time until it was...
It was everything we wanted to know.
Yeah.
He
laid a trap for Alec Murdoch, like, bravo.
And it was his strategy. It was not using that destructive cross, right?
I do think it was high risk, because you're typically... the common knowledge or wisdom is, no, don't ask these open-ended why questions and let the defendant run with things and give out his version. You have to control what he's saying by yes, no questions. He didn't do that, and it paid off for him big time. But I think at the time, as it was going on, I'm sure the pundits nationally were giving him a hard time for not following the rule book on this. But in hindsight, looking back, it turned out to be the exact right strategy.
Yeah, I think that's just because that was the state's whole point, is that Alec Murdoch, they said in court that Alec Murdoch had been a liar his whole life. he just he kept lying on the stand. Also, you know, Crane Waters kept saying, "Hey, jury, Alec Murdoch is looking you in the eyes right now, and he's lying to you. Look how effortlessly and easily he does it." And the jury got to see that while he was on the stand, because he kept backtracking and lying more. I mean, it was confusing.
Yeah, and he did get him on a really good point where he had very specific factual information to share on things he wanted to share. But on the big questions, it'd be a lot of like, "I don't recall," "I don't remember." And that I thought played well for the state.
That was tough. Now, you know, these guys had to sit in the hot seat and wait for this verdict to come in. They didn't have to wait that long.
I thought we might get a verdict that night. Just because, the jury's been there as long as we have. We're tired. You know the jury's tired. You can tell by looking over there at them. I felt like they had made up their minds one way or the other. I do think it came back a little quicker than I thought, but I didn't think we would be there the whole weekend.
When it came back fairly quick, and some of them say it was, roughly an hour, you think to yourself, either we definitely got it right and they understood what we were putting out there for them, or it went horribly wrong. It's one of the two. We felt pretty confident that we put a strong case out there, and I you don't ever want to jinx it.
So I try not to think about it. I don't want to talk about it. I really don't, because watching that jury for the jurors for 6 weeks, they were listening. They were listening, and I mean really listening. And I thought we'd get a verdict. I didn't know if it'd be that night or the next morning. On a 6 week trial, you don't know. But I thought they'd reach a verdict. And when we got word that they didn't want supper, you kind of knew at that point. But again, I'm superstitious, but I felt really good the way the case went up.
Charlie,
I'm just admiring the accents, right? Savannah Goode, Hemingway, South Carolina. John Metters, I think he's somewhere upstate South Carolina, and David Fernandez, not South Carolina, right?
Yeah, we did learn that about David.
So I just love hearing the voices, but I digress. Getting to what they're talking about, quick verdict. I mean, how impressive. You had a 6 week trial, and these jurors were so satisfied with the evidence produced to them and the arguments that they came back so quickly. I just thought it was just a tremendous victory for the state of South Carolina from that standpoint. The jurors were satisfied with the evidence.
Well, and when we've heard from jurors, as they've sort of, a few of them have spoken, and when they've spoken about the coming to the conclusion, two of the big things that stuck out to me was that the two pieces that really, really sold it for them were both decisions made by the defense, and that was to let Alec take the stand. Of course, it sounded like they had tried to at least show that they had some resistance to that when they spoke to Newman about it, but that and also sending them out to Moselle to really check out the scene there. Where the crime scene was. So they had made up their mind. I mean, I remember even seeing one of the jurors was dressed up, and he had been very down dressed throughout the entire trial. And I remember thinking, why is he dressed up? Well, because he's made up his mind and he's got a big decision to announce right now.
I thought it was just kind of a side note through the interview. John Metters kept talking about how superstitious he is and how throughout the trial they'd see wood and they'd go up and they'd knock on it. And then Creighton Waters said he was already superstitious, but John Metters made him more superstitious. So I guess, like, Charlie, when you're in that position, do you think about the verdict a lot, or do you think most of the time attorneys are just more focused on day to day?
Oh, no, you totally do. I think I've talked about this before. Jury trials are like elections. You get a result. And at the end of the day, you're going to get a guilty or not guilty, or it could be hung, but you get a result. And I just have to think that both sides of and by the way, I do think that the feeling I had on the defense side, I don't think they were subtle about this. I think they thought they would get a not guilty verdict, didn't you? I think they were pretty confident going into jury deliberations.
I think they were. I think that there was, I don't know, maybe I'm just reading into it, but I felt like I saw some furrowed brows leaving that room waiting for for the verdict. And certainly when they came back in that quickly, I think that was that was concerning.
I think they knew then.
And also just because all the family couldn't even be there because it happened so quickly. You know, I remember John Marvin had, hadn't he had gone home at that point?
I think he explained to me that he had a school visitation, looking at schools for his daughter, and was way away in Beaufort and couldn't get back in time anyway. So, but I did have the feeling, at least the defense family, for the most part, maybe with the exception of Randy, that did believe in his innocence. I mean, I think they really were supportive of him, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I just heard from Savannah, and it's lovely to hear her voice here, too. I mean, they all played such an important role, as Waters told us over and over again. Of course, we were missing a couple of people from the team.
Right. Not many,
in that
though.
Interview.
Yeah, but by the way, though, think about this now. You've got kudos, right, to you all to pull together this kind of an interview. I think it's unprecedented in a major trial to have them all sitting there. I mean, it was just remarkable to me to.
It felt like a unicorn moment. I was I was really thrilled that they would sit down with us.
Wow! Yeah, and by the way, getting back to Randy Marvin, I hope I'm not characterizing him wrongly, but. Randy Murdoch with the New York Times interview where he gave it more of a I don't know what happened, what the facts are, more of a neutral position. But I think all the rest of them really felt really strongly of his innocence, as I understand it, even to this day, because remember after the verdict, the defense was still putting out that they are as convinced as ever of his innocence, as I recall the press conference. So we'll see what happens on appeals.
Well, Savannah, we wanted to hear from her again real quick. Let's play a clip. This is really, the question was from Drew, and he said, I just want to know what your why is. When you go into something like this, you got to have a strong why. What's your passion? What's your why? Why are you doing it?
Just the defendant himself, someone in such a trusted position, someone with so much power, and just even a father. How could you do something like this? And then you have the nerve to take the stand and lie to the jury. Just how all this has proceeded, you know, from the start of the case. Just somebody like that shouldn't be allowed to get away with what he did. And going after people like that is why we do what we do.
That was one of the more insightful things that I heard through all that. And this is one of the things that's really sort of stuck with me. When we were just a little peek behind the curtain here, when we were planning this episode yesterday, and they Ann handed to me and Tara handed to me the kind of script for what we were thinking about here, I looked at it and I said, well, there's one thing that's not here that's got to be in there. And it was that little passage right there from Savannah Gow. And I had asked the whole room, it's like, you know, we all have our reasons for what we do, why we do what we do as far as our profession. I've been in journalism now. I'm on the backside of 15 years. I'm getting close to 20. And they are attorneys, they're prosecutors for a reason. You have some, and I asked them what it was about this trial that spoke to their why, that triggered their why, that sparked that flame in them. And that was Savannah's answer. And I thought it was, and you could tell it went beyond just it spoke to the human element of it, of a
visceral.
Yeah, it wasn't so much anything about her passions as a lawyer. It was humanity and the affront to humanity that this whole trial and Alec Murdoch's actions represent.
Mm-hmm. That's a very, very well put. And, you know, it was also speaks to what Wilson said earlier on, which was no one is above the law. No one is above the law. And he said, thank goodness we were able to show that to the people of South Carolina, that you can't get away with murder.
I thought it was just a really proud moment for South Carolina. If you step back from this, again, to give the history, which I think everyone knows at this point, it wasn't as if you were going against somebody that would be easy to prosecute from the standpoint of you name it. He had prominence, he had position, he had wealth. He was able to hire the attorneys of his choosing, very competent, able, top-rated attorneys. And the fact that the state of South Carolina put the energy, effort, and resources into bringing him to justice, we can criticize our system and, of course, can always stand improvement. But if you step back from it, at least in this case, well done.
And justice served. So I want to play one more clip because we need to know where we're going, of course. There's 99 financial charges against Alec Murdoch. We got an opportunity to hear that answer. As you mentioned, we were able to break some news on this. So it's out there as far as the report that we've already done. But we wanted to have this on the record to some degree, too, because we're going to have a lot more to report on this case from what they're telling us.
99 financial crimes still pending.
Yeah.
Thinking about three strikes and you're in, life without parole for Alec Murdoch?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yes, 100%.
You know, the legislature has defined breach of trust over $10,000 as a strike, and they made that decision. You know, we don't make the laws either. We you know, enforce the laws and apply those laws, and we're talking about somebody who allegedly has abused the trust that comes with that diploma and that certificate on the wall that we all have, and did so in a way that is, you know, unparalleled, allegedly. And again, those remain to be determined. He's presumed innocent of those and entitled to a fair trial, but we have planned to aggressively pursue those under the general's leadership.
I believe that every victim of every crime deserves to have their day in court, regardless of where the defendant is. Because a lot of people say, well, he's in prison for life, so you got him. So why are you going to waste our time? Well, he is irrelevant to their lives or their family's lives. So they deserve their day in court, and we're going to pursue every case that involves every other victim. They get their shot. They get their day in court. And again, as a matter of strategy, we expect that the appeal, we're going to defend the appeal. We expect him to be in prison for the rest of his life. But I would love to have that extra layer of you know, basically to kind of insulate, appeal-proof this thing. So we definitely want him to put him up on those charges for those various reasons.
What are the three cases? Which three cases are you going
to? Well, we're going to handle all of them. Well, so the way it's indicted is, you know, the indictments are broken up in the various counties. As you know, in South Carolina, again, you have to venue the case in the county where, there's a connection. But those indictments are generally broken up by the various victims. You know, there's multiple charges related to each one.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Well, you know, that just gave us a peek again. And thank you to this team. I mean, if they listen to this podcast, I really hope they know how much we appreciated them giving us such honest, clear direction on this. And once again, you know, we're not, the three of us are not lawyers except for Charlie. Charlie is the lawyer here with the legal mind. And, you know, to be able to have that opportunity to ask them directly, well, what do you mean? What are you going to do? How are you going to do this? And for them to really answer us so honestly was refreshing, especially as a journalist. I didn't feel like there were a bunch of guardrails on this. And I also had a chance to see them a little bit in their natural environment, speaking to each other in their own sort of legal fashion. Mm-hmm. So this is, the whole experience was really, really enlightening. And especially since we know that we're going to have the same characters going into some of these other cases that are so extremely important. We've spoken to Tommy Moore. There's a lot of victims out there that still need to hear from the state on this.
Yes. What a straightforward answer, though, right? I was really surprised.
Yeah.
We're going to prosecute every charge and seek another life without parole sentence, all 99. So I think it's five counties, right?
Yeah.
So a lot more court in store for Alec Murdoch. And will he plead guilty or not guilty?
Yeah, and that's not even counting maybe some of the other SLED investigations that are going on as well. So there's still a lot going on with this case for sure. As far as just to wrap it up right now, you know, anything that really stood out to you guys is just moments as we've been going through these post-trial interviews, especially getting to meet this team.
Yeah, I thought one moment was funny. It literally made me laugh out loud during our interview. Creighton Waters was talking about how when they interview people to be prosecutors for the state, how it's a really long process. And he said that they look for one main thing, and it was, quote, ain't scared. And he said that Savannah was ain't scared in her interview. And that's why, you know, whatever a reason why she was chosen. I just thought that was so funny.
He also called her a pit bull.
Yeah, he did. And then I think also just seeing John Metters, you know, he had a way of connecting with the jury that was very noticeable. He connects with people, obviously, all of us just talking to him. It was the first time we all talked to him one-on-one.
He's a hugger.
Besides Charlie, yeah, and he's a hugger. He gave us all a hug at the end of the interview. We were packing up. We were out at our car. We saw him coming out. We were all right? waving to him. I just think he has a way with people, and that was really cool to see in person. And he was so, like, funny and candid. He talked about, you know, the reason why that we could do this case is because I give them peanut butter every day. Just his little funny remarks was just fun to see.
And we didn't end up playing this for time, but we did ask him a little bit more to go on about, but you've heard this before by now. Thank God for Bubba. And he mm-hmm. retold that story about how his family was, his daughter and son-in-law or son and daughter-in-law?
Their dog Tater.
And their dog Tater barked at when he heard the Murdoch's dogs barking in the video as it was playing, and it was like a sign. But he addressed that. I thought John, one of the cool things for me is just sitting there and observing people and little takeaways. I'm kind of going in order as we were facing them, and as you've probably seen them, or if you're watching the video part of this. By the way, the video portion of this, if you're listening on the podcast, if you want to see the video, that will be on our YouTube channel. We're going to upload that. You can go watch the actual recording of this with the video clips. And as we speak, I'm working on editing and posting the full 2 hour interview, two and a half hour interview. I'm going to post the full length interview with all five of the prosecutors and post that to YouTube, ABC News 4 YouTube channel, WCIV ABC News 4. So it'll be there. It's not there yet. I'm working on it today is Thursday, March 30th. I'm hoping to have at least part one of that uploaded by tomorrow or over the weekend. So it's a work in progress. We'll announce on our social media when it's finally out, but that's happening. Yeah, but for me, just sitting there watching them as I'm going in reverse order on the far right, you've got David Fernandez. And what struck me with David is how personally he seemed to take it. And you could tell he was holding back a little bit more than others about how he just his body language and his eyes. There was a real anger there with him and about the facts of this case and what Alec Murdoch did. I picked up on that. He really, you felt like if you were sitting somewhere, anywhere where he didn't have a tie on and there was no cameras around, David would have just unleashed what he was really, really thinking. John Metters, to sit in a room with John Metters for 2.5 hours like we did, the man moves constantly. And you'll see this when we do upload the full videos. He's turning in his chair. He's like, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but think of a little 9-year-old boy who's been cooped up in a room all day, and he's got all this energy. John was from his chair, he was bouncing off the walls. He's very demonstrative. If you didn't pick up on that during trial, he talks with his hands. He touches people. He moves a lot and he's fidgety. I don't mean any of this in a negative sense, but he's just a ball of energy. And you could tell he was wanting to get up and run laps in that room while we had him sitting in a chair. Alan, very humble, a lot of humility is what I picked up on from Alan in the way he spent so much time in his interview. And of course, you'd want him to do that and expect him to do that as the Attorney General, but just praising the team around him. Creighton Waters. What I picked up there is a very sharp, wisecracking sense of humor that we got just little tastes of. He didn't unleash it, but you get the sense that Creighton could drop something a little bit dry, a little bit wry, if you will, that it's just funny as all get out. And he wanted to, and we saw a little bit of that with him. That was my takeaway with I think with Creighton, a lot of that. And it just, he seems like he'd be a lot of fun to be around. And after all, he moonlights as a rock star, as a guitar player. If you didn't know that about Creighton, he plays in bands and he's up there jumping around, jamming the solo lead guitar. The guy has a ton of personality, and we saw little glimpses of it. He was pretty buttoned up and tried to keep himself professional.
Well,
but you could tell.
Like clutch. Well, that was clutch. Yeah. As soon as I heard him say the word clutch, I was like
sports analogies.
Great yep. guy. Yeah, we got a lot of analogies. We got a lot of sports analogies for sure. Go ahead, Savannah.
Oh yeah, Savannah. I think that, again, I've already mentioned this, but what the lasting takeaway for me from her is just. She was content, I think, to let other people do a lot of the talking in there. And when we did come to her with that question, she just kind of like, she it was like a little bit of a shocker and like a punch, because like she's very few words, and then when she opens her mouth, it's a. She's got a lot to say and a lot with a lot of deep resonance to it. And there, it wasn't just platitudes or just, anything. She had very powerful, and she had a very powerful way of putting things.
Yeah. Do you have anything to add?
My moment. Yeah. That's thanks for the opportunity, because my moment was, all right, we've been together for a 6-week trial in Walterboro, South Carolina. And the moment for me was, I was in that building for 8 years as Attorney General. And so to have the prosecution team, almost all of them, and you all there at the same time, what a moment for me. It was really special.
I'm so glad. The world's colliding a bit.
And y'all did such a great job. I thought the questioning was great. I think they responded really well. They were very direct, just like you say, and it was it really was a moment of great journalism. And we got you got that hard news coming out that same day about the prosecuting 99 financial crimes, seeking another life without parole sentence for Alec Murdoch. I just thought that was really special.
Ann, what was your moment? You have another reporter in here, so I got to ask.
Oh.
Normally Ann can get away with saying.
And so we'll be off the thing. Well, I think that I agreed with you. I think that the levity of the situation of being in the state grand jury room, I just kept on feeling like as we walked through security, we walked back into this room, we were finally, honestly, getting like that peek behind the curtain. And as a journalist, there's just nothing that feels better than when you feel like you're getting the real story about what these people really feel. And to be able to ask them that, for them to answer that honestly, that was my overall impression, was that it was incredibly satisfying as a journalist to be able to put a bow on a part of the story that so many people, not just us, but so many people out in the world really wanted to know what they were thinking, what was their strategy, what was it like to have to cross Alec Murdoch when you knew what you already knew. And so I think I have to say it was that whole experience. Thank you for asking.
How cool was it at the end, Ann, to just be out there? And this is at the very end of this. We're packing up the gear. Some of them have already gone. It was just me, Ann, Creighton Waters, and David Fernandez hanging out in the hallway outside of the room, and they were just talking off the cuff at that point. And how cool was that for you?
It was great. It was great because they have to have gates up for journalists. I mean, that's just part of when you're working in such a high profile level, but to be able to speak you know, off the cuff a little bit, but just amongst ourselves, mm-hmm. as human beings, maybe as people that are covering this and obviously just going through the process of living and breathing these stories. It was very cool, Drew. And I wanted to say too, we've put it out there for the defense attorneys, for Dick Harpootlian and Jim Griffin and their team, and their PR folks that are helping handle the massive of requests, and we appreciate that. We have so far not been granted an interview with them, and it may well be due to time constraints with them. But also
legal reasons. I do think it's on appeal, and so what they.
But I do want people to know that we mm-hmm. have reached out to them mm-hmm. as journalists. It's important for us to stay fair and balanced in our storytelling and in our coverage, and we will continue to reach out to Senator Harpootlian and Jim Griffin. And to his defense team, I would love to hear how they were mm-hmm. living and breathing this mm-hmm. as well, but for legal reasons.
Yeah, I think maybe they may not be able to, because what they say at this point in time before the appeal is heard could possibly come back to hurt their client.
Exactly. So. And so just so everybody is on the same page about that, that is where we're coming from as a team as well. Please, if you have enjoyed our podcast, please leave us 5 stars and write a review and let us know what you're thinking. And obviously, we have a lot of social media channels that you can reach out to us, and we're always wanting to hear more of what you want to hear about. We also want to make sure that you're aware that we are at the same time in tandem, if you can imagine it, running another podcast that we've been working on all year, Finding Brittany Drexel. We're coming up soon to actually the anniversary of her death and the arrest of the man who was accused of killing her. We would love for you to follow Finding Brittany Drexel, also under Unsolved South Carolina. So for today, this is a long one, but boy, did we have a lot to cover. And we're just so grateful for everybody's time in this room and out there. Keep on following us. We're going to have a lot more on this, obviously, because this story is not going anywhere. Thank you so much from myself, Ann Emerson, Charlie Condon, Drew Tripp, Tara Jabor, Max Harrison. We'll see you soon.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Allow your imagination to be piqued by stories that are brought to life through captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. As an Audible member, you'll be able to keep your heart rate up month after month because you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. If you're in the mood for a shocking psychological thriller, check out None of This Is True by Lisa Jewell. Embrace brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.